Well, good afternoon. It's very good to see everyone here. It's my real privilege today to introduce our visiting speaker, Dr. Mark Gopin, who is the director of the Center for World Religions, Diplomacy, and Conflict Resolution at George Mason University at their Arlington campus. I first had the privilege of meeting Mark many years ago in 1999 when I took a couple courses at the Summer Peacebuilding Institute. And Mark co-taught religion, source of conflict, resource for peace, along with Ron Crable. And I was so impressed with his knowledge and the lectures that he gave. And so when we were finally able to get a hold of him, I was very pleased when he accepted the invitation from both us and the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding to come spend a day with us, do a couple of presentations, and interact. Mark has, I should mention that I should have introduced him as Rabbi Dr. Mark Gopin, because he's both a rabbi and a PhD. His PhD is in ethics from Brandeis University, and he's the author of at least 5 books, and I think my sense, given the title of his presentation tonight, is that maybe he's going to be speaking somewhat out of the 5th book, The Bridges Across Impossible Divide, The Inner Lives of Arab and Jewish Peacemakers, because he's talking about the inner life and how it relates to peace building. But he's been very involved in a lot of Middle East peace building in Israel-Palestine, Syria, Iran, and I'm sure other countries that I'm forgetting. So we're very pleased to have you here, Mark. I should also say that I found out today that he's very adaptable and can fit in as it is, because when I went by to pick him up in Rockville today, my car wouldn't start, so we had to come in his car. So he drove down instead of me driving my car. So that was another little adventure this morning. So Mark, we very much look forward to your presentation and then a chance for some questions and discussion.
I often like to look at the introduction, you know, that has my picture and everything, because it's a good reminder and helpful guide when I get up to speak in many different places of who I am, because you often forget that. And I so many different times in my life I was in various Buddhist settings when they were trying to prove that there is no ego and there is no real person, and it's a fiction, and these are the reasons why it's fiction I'm trying to understand intellectually. And then, but I didn't, because from a theological point of view, I come from a theological construct that says, no, there is a soul, and people have souls, and a lot of the Buddhist rebellion against Hinduism and others was no soul. It was called anatta. And part of that was for good reason. It was a critique against the overvaluation of your own soul that it ends up being egotistical and corrupt and saving your own soul. And so the Buddha comes along and says, well, no, there's no soul, and it's also an analysis of the fragmentation of everything, etc. And I'm thinking to myself, no, theologically it doesn't work. And then I get up to speak, and I realize, no, I really don't know who I am. So maybe they're right. Each time I try to figure out based on where I am, and part of my own problem as a person is that I change based on my environment in a radical way. And so I'm constantly figuring out who I am, but I think I can only really do it in the shower, and the shower is a very authentic space for many, many people. Many people have received their inspirations for books and ideas and everything in the shower, because if you think about it, it's one of the few places in the world where you're not in a social context. You're decidedly not in any social context whatsoever. Even in the desert, you feel like, okay, I'm here with the animals, and I have to make a good impression. I'm a Thoreau type, and I'm here, and I'm doing the desert thing. I'm living up to the desert model, and maybe I'm a monastic like the monks that used to be here. But shower is just, it's just water and you. So thank you very much for coming here. This brings up a new identity for me, or an old identity of what I used to be when I was here in the 90s. And it was, would you like me to?
I want to see your face. I can't see
it. Oh, sure. Okay. Okay. Okay, good. That's, you're right. It's, I'm short. It's all these interesting cultural things coming up. So I used to be here in the 90s, and I spoke from this spot in the 90s, and so it's very odd, because Eastern Mennonite was very different back then, and there were a whole different cast of characters, and the SPI in the summer is a very international group, so it was also different then, and some people in the audience are here, a few people from those old days, and so much transpires in life that changes you. And the subject that I have today is to talk about, you know, self-examination. Because some things, I'd say that in the last 20 years, I was self-examined then, and I'm self-examined now, but then I always had anxiety attacks associated with it. And so, if there's anything, you know, then I'm more used to the process of self-examination and recognition of failure and fragmentation than I used to be. It used to be a really traumatic experience. You get used to it as you get older. You get used to failure more. You get more comfortable with that, and more resigned to the fact that you're, you know, moving in a certain direction. So. I want to share with you the reason why I wanted to highlight this particular subject of bridges. It was the name of this book is Bridges Across an Impossible Divide. I spent 30 years trying to build bridges in Israel between Palestinians and Israelis. And I'm not Israeli. I was not born Israeli. I have no citizenship there. I don't want citizenship there. I'm not a practicing rabbi, which means in the Jewish context, it means that I have the title because it's unlike in a lot of Christian contexts. In Christian contexts, if you're a priest, it means you're functioning that way. But a rabbinic title simply means that you studied a certain amount and you got ordination at a certain point in your life. But I'm not practicing in that sense. But it was a part of my narrative. I actually got ordination, I think it was in 84. But from the very beginning, I was working on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And a love of Israel was a deep part of my identity, really, for 40 or 50 years. My whole life, my childhood, was rooted in Jerusalem. I grew up in Jerusalem, even though I was born and raised in Boston. And one of the interesting parts of this whole legacy and saga is something that I described in some films that I had done. This book is part of a film. There was a film series on peace partners, and then there was a book that was based on the films. And so I'm in here too. I have a chapter, and I'm my peace partner in this set was a Syrian Christian, my age, closer to my age. And that's because I've worked in Syria for 10 years, inside Syria every year, sometimes twice a year. And so I figure in this book too. But what's happened is that this book is a book that, in the interviews that I did, and the interviews that they did with me, were very much about looking at the internal life and the internal evolution of the peacemaker. And we can talk, there's many, many technical things to speak about in terms of conflict analysis and conflict resolution and systems theory and some of the evolution of my thinking. And I'll get to some of this on nonviolence. But I first I want to just cover what why all of my books and all of my practice has been so focused on the inner life, and why I think that's at the core of the issue of peace and conflict and peace and war, is that, and I was speaking to somebody before, is that the most interpersonal book I have, and the most personal book, is Healing the Heart of Conflict, and it's on 8 stages of evolution of a path of being of healing conflicts. It's called Healing the Heart of Conflict, and the first step of that I called B, but B was really self-examination. And I found, and one of the reasons I started emphasizing this is because I found that the professionalization of peace and peace processes was the exact opposite of self-examination. That what was rewarded in the field of diplomacy was in the careerism of this, was people who had developed very sophisticated political careers, and they raised themselves to a certain level, and they were ready to be those peacemakers. In many ways, they were more arbitrators. I think especially of some of the cast of characters on a political level, from Henry Kissinger to those who were involved in Bosnia after the war. And a lot of people who come into conflicts are... It's not about self-examination. It's really about enforcing a kind of control on a crazy situation, and it is understandable why international statesmen feel they need to do that. And there's a lot of you have to develop a lot of respect for that. I once had a really important conversation to me with George Mitchell, and George Mitchell's the height of George Mitchell's success. It was in many ways the way that after what I believe was 20 years of peace building by thousands of amazing people in Belfast and Northern Ireland, we reached a critical mass, and like I said in the previous lecture, there were very, very few people left in the world who were committed to a perpetual fight of Protestants and Catholics. 1,000 years was enough for most Christians. People had it, and it was the last spot, really, in the world where there was this principled fight. It wasn't over theology, but it was still a Protestant-Catholic fight. And what's amazing about the resilience of conflict is that it only takes a few funders to make a situation artificially continue, because all you need is some good money on both sides, some weapons, and then a lot of fear, and suddenly the majority are who want a peaceful settlement or coexistence are overshadowed by the sheer amount of resources that go into militancy. And it was clear that there was serious militancy. I knew I come from Boston. So I knew that there was, all this bag money and IRA money coming out of Boston. I didn't know that there were that Ian Paisley and others were receiving so much funds from Southern evangelical sources and Southerners as well. So I didn't realize, again, the people of, the tens of millions of Americans of Irish descent were having a proxy war in Belfast. And then when I got to Belfast and I started to be educated by people, I'm very abstract. I come out of the world of studying Talmud and getting PhDs in ethics, and I don't like looking at things. I like thinking about things. But when I got to Belfast, it was Brendan McAllister who I met here, and he took me around Belfast, and he was a student of John Paul Lederach's, and he loved John Paul, and he sort of liked me. He always said, I really love John Paul. It was really, we had this thing going, But he took me around. He said, I said, Brendan, I don't have to go. He said, no, I'm going to show you the Shankill. I have to show you the Shankill. I have to show you this street and that street. And I said, okay, I get it, But he took me, and I saw the geography of conflict, and I realized, he said, in these people in the suburbs, there are Catholics and Protestants living in the suburbs together, but then there's these two roads. And I said, oh my God, this is a ritual recreation. This is the last space. It isn't just Northern Ireland that's the last vestige of a 1,000-year fight. It's two roads. And then there are people, I met somebody from the suburbs in Belfast who actually worked in London and preferred to live in Belfast because of the quality of life. This was at the height, this was in the Troubles. This was when there was violence going on. And he preferred the quality of life in a suburb of Belfast because he liked it. So what that spoke to me volumes was is that there was a ritual war going on. It was a ritual continuation of something for some people. And that's often when you feel a place, when you feel yourself and you say, most people here are really I'm tired of this, and most people in the world, and yet there's this space to keep the ritual going. That attachment to ritual conflict, it's a basic form of my identity. And I learned, and I listened, and I listened, and I realized, and I looked deeply into myself of where are my ritual spaces of perpetuation of conflict. What's ritual for me? It was easy for me to look at the Irish and say, oh my gosh, it's like, it's not like a spontaneous riot somewhere in a Hindu city where somebody slaughtered a cow, somebody insulted somebody, and a spontaneous thing broke out. This is every year they know exactly when they're going to start fighting again. And I said, oh my God, what is that? So it's Lisa Shirk has written a very important book on ritual and myth and peace and conflict. And so once you get to the depths of that, you can't just stay there and say, oh, pity the Irish. Because anything that the Irish are doing, everyone's doing. Whatever you see anywhere in the world that's conflict and it looks bizarre to you, the most dangerous thing is to think it's them and not you. Because somewhere in your soul, you're doing exactly the same thing, or you want to, or you don't even realize that everyone around you is doing that. So I looked at that and I said, okay, they're ritually doing this. They're repeating it predictably every time, every year at a certain time. Most people aren't involved anymore, but there's two roads they have reserved for people who are. And then I said, oh, Passover, Tisha B'Av. And I looked at my calendar. And then I looked at the Serbian calendar and I look at this calendar and they're all ritualized forms of victimization. Every calendar has within it. I've been working in Iran for a few years. And with my Iran, you know, I start studying the Shiite calendar. I say, oh, everywhere you go, you see the continuation in some form of identity of the perpetuation of an old conflict that gives identity, that gives meaning, that gives purpose, that gives a place in the world that makes sense. It makes sense of the world. And contrary to a lot of the research, and I know the latest fad, I'll put down my coffee for a minute. The latest fad is that we all want to be happy. I'm not convinced we all want to be happy. My evidence of all my peace work for 30 years is that we all want meaningful constructs. We want to know our place in the world. We want to have a sense of meaning. Because so many people work very hard at being unhappy. You know, we all know people like that, but we all, you know, we have structures that we're into that purpose doesn't appear to be happiness. But it does appear to be, the anxiety comes from not having a place in the world. And conflict gives you a place in the world. And that's why one of the reasons why it's so hard to get rid of. It's been very hard for me to shed my need for anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is fundamental to my identity. My whole family history, I never tire of telling people about, you know, this brother-in-law who watched his rabbi crucified in a village in Russia and then burned to death. And this one that has lashes on his back. And this one, this is the village I come from where all 300 people were shot in one day in 1942 by the Ukrainian police. And one Nazi, you know, one German Nazi in town. And, you know, this is my narrative. I'm old enough, unfortunately, to be this transitional figure between a world of Jews who deeply embedded in Holocaust and victimhood and a lot of younger people who aren't into that. They're into all sorts of other things, but they don't identify as much with that unless they really get taught that victimhood. And you do teach victimhood. A lot of religion is about teaching the memory of victimhood, a lot of ritual religious cycles. So in the end of the day, I could have gone to Belfast and done my thing and said, you know, these people are just crazy. But the self-examination side, you know, said to me, yeah, they're crazy and we're all crazy. We all have odd aspects to us where sometimes conflict and violence and being in these relationships is much more familiar and compelling than not being in those relationships. And so early on in my peace work, my own self became a source of my scientific research, as it were. And a lot of anthropologists feel this way. In the 19th century, you know, to their credit, the person I wrote my dissertation on, who was a great moral sense theorist, a Jewish Orthodox moral sense theorist from Padua in Italy, and he wrote, moral sense theory is one of the theories of ethics. There's a number of interesting approaches to ethics and philosophy, and I'm a big believer that philosophy changes the brain. And one of them is Kantian ethics, which focuses on principles, non-negotiable principles that are universal. Another one focuses on consequentialism and the search for the greatest happiness for the greatest number, or in the Dalai Lama approach, the least amount of suffering for the greatest amount of people, a sort of Buddhist model. And then moral sense theory is the cultivation of basic moral senses like compassion and justice, a sense of compassion. And all of it is being backed up more and more by really interesting science, brain science. And I was really intrigued by the fact that the guy that I wrote my dissertation on, he wrote 4 autobiographies. I said, why did the guy, you know, was he a narcissist? Why did he have to write 4 autobiographies? But it turns out that in the mid-19th century, he was a really serious scientist. And he was very religious, but he was a serious scientist. And there's all these interesting European types that combine science and religion. Since then, I've learned how many Sufis do that, and how many people in Iran, and how many al-Afghani, and so many different people around the world were not just either secular or religious, but people were deeply religious and deeply scientific. And that model was there already for many centuries in different models. So he was very scientific, and what they were increasingly seeing in the 19th century was that the 18th century Enlightenment was good, they found a lot of positive stuff, but a lot of the secrets of why we are the way we are right inside of ourselves. And so any legitimate person thinking about human nature was doing a lot of self-examination. And he was writing all these autobiographies, and he was studying himself. And it turns out that has a long pedigree and a long history in all the great wisdom traditions of the world. All the great wisdom traditions, you know, right back to the oracle in ancient Greece saying, know thyself. Know thyself. You know, and Talmudic statement saying, who is the hero? Who is Gibor in Hebrew it's more than hero. It's like, who's the warrior? Who's the real warrior? The one who can conquer his own spirit. The one who can examine and conquer his own spirit. And so I looked at a lot of my colleagues and my peace work and the work in Israel, and one of the damaging effects of being in a conflict that doesn't get solved is that you can't help it but be a peacemaker that tends to blame yourself. What didn't I do? What didn't we do? What's wrong with us? And this is where other forms of examination become very valuable. My studies have moved more and more and towards large aggregated models of where peace is breaking out, where nonviolence is occurring, and how it occurs, in order to almost forgive the peacemakers, or in order to give us a break, give us a chance from the way we destroy ourselves by taking on the guilt of failure. But this was a very common characteristic that people were working with zero resources. And the more I got into the work in Israel and the more I did these studies, the more I realized that these people didn't have a fighting chance. That the amount of forces keeping conflict going were so much wealthier and so much more well endowed, and so many people in the world were committed to that conflict continuing, that they were wrong to compare themselves to the Irish. You know, there was a period of time when Irish peace builders and Israeli-Palestinian peace builders were talking a lot. And people had an idea, let's put them together. You know, they're both sort of at the same stage, intractable conflict, it sort of festers all the time, it doesn't seem to go anywhere, relatively few deaths. You know, there's also, we look at, you know, relatively few deaths in Northern Ireland and in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict relative to, say, Rwanda, you know, or, you know, big genocidal moments, big war moments like Iraq. It's like, oh, maybe these people can work it out together. Imagine the shame as it becomes clear that the Irish are moving forward and Israelis and Palestinians are totally failing. Imagine the feelings in the Arab world that the world is moving forward with all of these different democratizations and, you know, we're not. People tend to take it upon themselves. They say, something's wrong with us. Something's deeply wrong with us. Now that's the irony, is that self-examination is critical. But self-examination in 19th century and the great philosophers didn't mean self-hatred. There's a difference between self-examination and self-hatred. Because self-examination leads to some pretty difficult things, as we all know in this room. But the foundations of ethics in the great philosophies is self-love. And the place that those moral sense theorists in the 19th century got that self-love was the first step was a neo-biblical construction. And that is the Old Testament notion of loving your neighbor as yourself. Well, how the heck do you love your neighbor if you hate yourself? So the formula, love your neighbor as yourself, ahavt l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor, and it's very hard to translate the Hebrew. It may mean love your neighbor, he is you. Love your neighbor, he is you. It's a weird Hebrew expression. Or love your neighbor as you love yourself. It's hard to know. But one thing is very clear, is that if you hate yourself, then it's going to be harder. I know people that love everyone else and hate themselves. I have a lot of that in myself. But we also know in history that it's very, very dangerous to hate a piece of yourself. Do you know that one of the worst things that Hitler hated about himself was that he had a piece of him that was Jewish? The worst thing in the world in terms of genocide is to have somebody in absolute power who detests some part of his legacy. Because often the genocide becomes a way in which they stamp out something about themselves. That's more sick and dangerous than anything else in the world. So self-loathing is a very dangerous thing. Self-loathing is a very dangerous thing. So self-examination is the key, but what I found with a lot of peace builders is that it turns into self-loathing because they're blaming themselves for what is not moving forward. And what I wanted to try to do was to first of all, eventually with later thinking and practice and studies, come to a way to understand why peace breaks out in some places and not others that lets peace builders off the hook, but also not just romanticize peace builders and have a way of saying, okay, this thing we did was better, this thing we did was a little worse. In other words, have some form of evaluation, but not an evaluation that assumes that if peace hasn't broken out, there's something wrong with the peacemakers in Ireland in the 1970s. There's something wrong with the peace builders in Palestine or in Israel because they can never solve their conflict. It's a very dangerous approach. And what I came up with was, and what I'm working on much more now, are the aggregate, I mean, and I haven't written this out yet, but basically, like I said about Ireland, very, very few people in the universe were still committed to Protestant Catholic warfare. It was very, very few people, and yet it continued, because with a little bit of money, you can do a lot of damage in the world. But when you think about how how many centuries there has not been a formula for Jews and Muslims and Christians to talk about Jerusalem and about their heritage and about their differences and about what they share and about what's holy and what's holy to them, and how many millions of people in every one of those religions all want Jerusalem for themselves. You got the makings of millions and millions of people who are still committed to conflict. Nothing like Northern Ireland in terms of the energy going into the situation. And once there are millions of people who are still unresolved about that and want it just for themselves, then you have all sorts of mechanisms by which you can continue a war. You can do it through a think tank. You can do it through a foundation. You can do it through a suicide bomber group. You can do it through an intelligence agency. You can do it through fundraisers. You can do it through planting forests. I never knew planting forests could be a violent act until I discovered that there's an entire forest in Palestine now that's planted by a leading evangelical in the United States on Palestinian land as a gift to the people, the Jewish people of Israel. You know, and I said, oh, you can plant trees and continue warfare too. You know, once you're in that state of conquest, you don't have to pick up a gun. There's so many different creative ways to keep conflicts going, all based on a level of self-examination that will be required by the children of Abraham, by Muslims, Christians, and Jews to grapple with this space, not to mention, on top of it, Palestinians who lived there and Israelis who now live there and what they have to grapple with. But when I looked at them and I saw the sheer number of people, I said, of course, that their efforts are overwhelmed by massive amounts of money and will to keep the conflict going. At the same time, with all that said and done, I wanted to study these people, because one of the things about self-examination and examination of the interior lives of peacemakers is that they're very flawed people. They have all sorts of narcissistic troubles. They make all sorts of mistakes with family all the time. Many, many things go wrong with peace builders. They're very flawed people. But they also have these, I was looking for their common characteristics, and also where is their genius? And I was particularly looking at peace partners, because one of the interesting questions is what keeps a relationship going when everyone else has abandoned relationships? Why is it that when, you know, in a period of no war, no peace, a thaw in relations, you see thousands of people rushing in with all their organizations and their money, and they're doing all these things, and then it all disappears when war breaks out or violence breaks out, the money dries up. Who stays when the money dries up? That's the most interesting question. One of the things that was so interesting about my Syria work that made it so different was that nobody could get into Damascus to the 10 years I was working there. Nobody, the police state was so effective that almost nobody was running any programs. People were there, people were sent people, you could go in, but to have an office or to do anything, you know, substantial, you know, everything was totally, totally controlled. So it became obvious to my, I went in 2003, 2004 I started. I had gone through an extremely traumatized period of which war was it? Yeah, there was 2000, there was the Intifada, the second Intifada was what broke me. Everyone is broken by some other conflict. That was the one that broke me, and then there was Lebanon. So anyways, I end up in Syria because my Syrian peace partner invited me to come to Syria, and I was in a state of shock. Why would she invite this rabbi to come and give a major speech? And how was she doing that? And how was she pulling that off? So I tell the story in here. And Hinn did this by having a unique approach to diplomacy and peace building, and that is that she was friendly with all sides. She was Christian, which made her more privileged in Damascus. She, because the regime is run by the Alawite minority, they are a offshoot of a they're more accepted by Shiites, less by Sunni. They're their own religion, but most of them are effectively secular now, highly secretive group. They were persecuted for centuries, right? And they constitute maybe 7% or 10% of the population in Syria, and maybe another 10% is Christian, and then some Shiites, and then about 70% Sunni Muslim. And as a Christian, she was more privileged, because what often when minorities take over a country or they take a regime, they gather all the minorities to them, and they basically say, you're either with us or you're dead. We'll give you over to the majority, and the majority are being brutalized, and they're going to kill you if we lose power. And this happens all over the world. It's a constant pattern with putting it's the whole book by one of our older colleagues called Minorities in the Middle. I forget who it was in Syracuse. Who was in Syracuse? Who was our colleague in Syracuse? Yeah. I think Lou wrote. No, I don't know if Lou wrote that book. It's called Minorities in the Middle. So minorities are perfect for this. And so as Christians, they were really stuck, and they're stuck, deeply stuck right now. And so, you know, Hinn went to school with Bashar. She went to the same school, so she knew the people who were in charge, and at the same time, she was a human rights attorney, an immigration lawyer, and she's working with people on the ground. And those kind of people, we call them social connectors. They do things that other people can't do, but at the same time, it's a police state. And so one of the patterns that I started to notice in all the great peace builders is that they're incredible connectors of human beings. They operate in ways that without organizations, just by the nature of their personhood, of charisma, of talking, of connecting people, that makes things happen that shouldn't be able to happen based on the system. And one of the things that became apparent to us was that we could not bring a dime into that system. Because the moment we brought in a dime to that system, it would be accused of being a Zionist conspiracy. Okay, any excuse to make her into a traitor, and especially with me as a partner, would have been seized upon. So basically, it's the only time in my life, and again, people, we had a problem with the fact that nobody in Washington believed somebody must be funding us. Nobody could believe we weren't being funded. Nobody could believe that we're actually spending thousands of dollars every year, because you just don't do that in the peace business. But that's what was happening. And it was dinners, it was public conferences, it was a lot of things on television. We were not allowed to work with people on the ground. We couldn't do the kind of humanitarian work that MCC does. We couldn't touch poor people. But we could get on television whenever we wanted and demonstrate a culture of debate, demonstrate interfaith relations, demonstrate the power and importance of pro-social values, and we could get into every living room. It was an irony of the situation, a paradox, because there was the right timing, and we have other scholars who talk a lot about timing. The timing was such that the regime was deeply worried about Rumsfeld, Cheney, and Bush wanting to attack. And so they wanted to show a good face to Syria. But we just wanted to get into everyone's living rooms. So it was this delicate process. But in the process, I learned a great deal about the people who stand in the middle and do these things. Because at every step of the way, every single one of our words was being examined and watched. Every single movement sometimes. And I said to people at lunch that I didn't realize that I actually came out of that and the Israeli experience with a lot of post-traumatic stress. Because every moment I was asking myself, what am I saying and what's going to happen to my people if I say the wrong thing? What if I lose my temper just once? So one time I did lose my temper because I have a bad temper. I have a bad temper for going into a police state and not knowing the language, then that's when I get nervous. So I think my bad temper is limited to certain radical experiences, but I can lose my temper. And so I was on this panel, and it was interesting. It was not about Israel. It was from what I didn't expect. It was from a fellow panel member who was a Catholic priest. He's an older man with a very powerful, booming voice. I later learned that he was a close friend of Bashar's. And he, in the middle of this thing, the Mufti is treating me wonderfully, everybody's treating me nicely. They hate Israel. Okay, I get that. That's not surprising. They don't love Palestinians. That's upsetting. But I'm there, and I'm the one talking about Palestinians, as I talked about. But then he starts in right to my right, and he starts with this booming voice, and he says, "The Jews are responsible for everything in the Middle East. And it's the Jews that brought this there, and nothing was wrong until the Jews got here." And he started going, with a very strong voice. And I was transported to the Holocaust. I was dying. And the cameras are looking at me, and I was just in hell. As a Catholic priest with a booming, deafening voice, and I was back with a Nazi right next to me. It didn't help that I knew that Damascus was a place that harbored Nazi criminals. It didn't help that the Ba'athist Party was inspired by the Nazi Party in part. And that, in fact, the old Ba'athists had, it didn't help, because I always knew lurking. And I was worried. I was worried about the security services. I knew, I didn't have the heart to tell my Syrian partner that, something smells very bad here, and that there's a murderous core. And sure enough, now it's turned out to be true. It's the worst police services in the entire Middle East, and there's a lot of bad security services. But no one tortured people as widely and as gleefully and as many children as the security services have turned out to do in Syria. It's not just 60,000-70,000 dead. It's many, many people who bled to death and purposely. It's unimaginable. I'm not going to tell you the horrible stories. But and it all came to me in that moment when this guy was yelling, "It's the Jews." So you never know when your inner life is going to erupt. And I didn't lose my temper, but I was shaking very badly. And then as the second the press conference was over, I it was like a room like this, very crowded, and I walked briskly down the front, and I ran out of the building, and I walked down the street, and I said, "I'm never coming back to Syria again." I didn't even know where I was walking. And my Syrian partner is running after me, and the Alawite director is running after me, and the whole place is erupting because I walked out. Later on, it was reported in two newspapers, we thought Dr. Gopin understood the Syrian people. So really, they were watching everything that I did. So that can create trauma. And later on, I learned that, "Mark, don't worry, nobody likes this old man, and he always talks like that, and don't worry, and, don't worry, no problem." many, many things people said to reassure me, but in the end of the day, it's the self-examination that got me through. Hind's husband, who was always very apolitical, but the man whose house I stayed in, said, "Don't worry, every year Mark comes back and he says, 'I'll never come back again,' and he always comes back." So this is, getting to know yourself, getting to know yourself. But what interested me was the way in which the true warriors for peace are people who persist in impossible circumstances and who keep to relationships no matter what. And I'm interested in that and those characteristics. So I came out with a few of them that I wanted to share with you. And I want to tell you a story about one of the people, and then we'll move to questions. So the personality traits that most interested me I divided into traits of worldviews and fundamental beliefs. I'll just go through a few of these, and also the attitude to partnership. What I saw in a lot of the peace builders that I examined was a desire to inquire and to know the whole truth wherever it leads, a strong sense of ethnic roots that's combined paradoxically with universal love, a patience and a suspension of judgment, curiously a dignity and love of land as related values, searching always for the heart of even the most violent enemies or tough adversaries, a determination that they're interested in everyone's heart, even the most violent people. A desire for leadership through social network creation, not so much through building programs, but through social network creation. A long-term engagement with adversaries, as you know well here. Now, worldviews and fundamental beliefs were interesting, and this cuts across all the religions and secular religious. Most of them were spiritual, but they weren't all, they certainly weren't all terribly religious. A belief in the reality and power of unity and oneness, a simple commitment to hope as an inherent bedrock value, faith in common people over leadership, a belief in bonds between people as more consequential than any concrete borders or boundaries, a Socratic faith in discussion and debate, a faith in the importance and power of forgiveness, in apologies and heart-to-heart work, a family paradigm of global human relations, a mental construct focusing on family, a faith in empowerment, and a faith in the power of healing through ritual, and a commitment to land as a basis for healing and peace. That's more in the Israeli-Palestinian case, curiously enough. Now, the other thing that was really fascinating was the integrated use of word and heart and deed. So there was an indirect means of social change, such as through the encouragement of shared moments of joy, embrace, song, all as vehicles to prepare for listening, nonverbal communication, ritual, and dance, a search for gestures beyond words when they come from the heart, a level of emotional honesty as the basis, sole basis for conversation, not an interest in dialogue and debate as much as a heart-to-heart conversation. This is especially true in the Middle East. Storytelling as a core way of communication. A radical flexibility of interventions. My Syrian partner would always say, and this is most interesting in a police state, the worst place in the world to work and think you can actually accomplish something. Every day she'd say to me, Mark, flexibility. Flexibility, Mark, flexibility, because we had to change our plans constantly and stay ahead of the authorities and everyone else who wanted to destroy the process. Very often it would just be jealous people. Very often it would be people who would want to report on you because they were jealous or they wanted to be the big person with, you know, Bashar or something like that. So flexibility of intervention is something that's the opposite, really, of the international constructs of conflict resolution. Canceling and creating programs on fairly short notice in order to minimize conflict and tension with all sides and power groups. Positive messaging, only positive messaging. Not problem solving, not looking for the problems, but only positive messaging. And it turned out that a police state was a great place to realize that, because if your messaging was ever negative, you were dead. You'd be put across the border. So I wouldn't have lasted 2 seconds in Syria if I had any negative things to say. Once or twice I slipped, like I said to a group once, you know, I just was totally sick and tired of anti-Zionist comments that didn't come with any concrete alternatives. And that people are brilliant at that in a lot of these circumstances. In general, people are enmeshed in conflict. They're really good at saying what's wrong. And so, you see, the word anti-Zionist doesn't lead you very much other than warfare, but the word Palestinian can lead you a lot of good places. That's an identity, that's a people, that's a person. You can work with people, but you can't work with the word anti-Zionist. That means a whole group of people have to disappear. But you can work with the word Palestinian. So once I was in front of a group and they're saying the Zionist this and the Zionist that, and I said, why am I the only one who talks about Palestinians? Why don't you ever talk about Palestinians? And that was an interesting moment where everybody shut up. They said, oh, they realized. But I got away with one little thing that was negative. But I had to be, we had to be very careful. The other thing is a truth-telling about your own group that stimulates the truth-telling in the other group. And I know a lot of you practice that in your work. Friendship. And this is one of the most interesting things, is the incredible power of friendship. The unbelievable way in which, you know, Gabi and Ihab are two figures in here. They both used to do this amazing thing called called the Sulcha celebration. It was a place where Palestinians and Israelis would sing and dance all night long, and then during the day they would listen to each other. So it was a very sort of hip kind of thing based on music and dance, but then half the day was spent listening. And it was a very specific, formalized form of listening, not debate as much as listening. And then the bonding of dance. These two ran it. They ran it on almost no money. And they were always out of money. They were always in trouble. And the depth of what of the way in which they bonded and knew each other. So Gabi would say in the interview, he'd say, you know, I have a temper, but Ihab is always saying to me, you know, Gabi, go slower. And Ihab was didn't show up on time to anything, so they both were, you know, the Agabi the Jew was being too nervy and too fast and too angry, and Ihab was never showing up, and so, you know, they had their cultural problems and they complemented each other. But that's the thing, is that friends know each other's weaknesses and they build this complementary kind of, you know, deep relationship. They also had a fascinating habit of having no boundaries, of anybody was welcome. So there were a group of people who wanted to come to sing and dance because they wanted a vacation in Israel. They could come over from the West Bank, and then they could go to Tel Aviv to the beach. And one thing about landlocked Palestinians in West Bank is that they were cut off from beaches by nature of the occupation. And they couldn't go to Gaza either. And so, you know, Gabi and Ihab look at this now. If they were running a serious professional program, they'd say only the qualified people can come who are serious about conflict resolution, not people who want to go to the beach. And they just looked at each other and said, okay. And so they let them go to the beach. Because in the end, it was not about, you know, having rigorous professional construct. It was about the kindness and compassion that were being displayed, you know, through the group. I want to get to questions soon. One of the people that influenced me the most and sort of changed my mind on the whole issue of conflict resolution theory, if, you know, because I come from a school and a lot of people, I write a lot of books, and people think I'm a theoretician. The truth is, I just got a dissertation in a field that I couldn't write. My dissertation was in Jewish studies, and I just couldn't bring myself to write academic articles on it. So I wrote these hybrid books from Oxford, and then people decided I was a theoretician. So I ended up in theory building and conflict resolution. And one of the most important things when you're in theory is to recognize how ignorant you really are, and also how much genius is native to the world, how much resilience there is in the world. One of the most exciting things about living on a planet of 7 billion people that are communicating with each other a lot is that crowdsourcing is proving that the collective intelligence of the human race is massive. When people really consult with each other and they find the ways to do that, things happen that have never happened in history. So you opened up the net and you say, could everybody please help us map the stars? And you get millions of responses from people who know exactly where this star is and that star and that, and the constellations, and it's all being figured out by people all over the world. Wikipedia is this crazy thing that all the scholars poo-pooed, and before you know it, it's being run by very sophisticated processes, and we all go to Wikipedia to find our knowledge. Of course, it's not perfect. But it's the biggest encyclopedia the world has ever seen or ever will see. Then there's Google, which is magic. It's a brain now. Our brain has now been extended to Google. My Google is part of my brain. It's part of my every conversation when I'm teaching my children. So I started to realize that genius is something, if we're still looking for conflict resolution, and we know that many, many PhDs in conflict, many PhDs in physics, many PhDs who can make bombs, do brilliant things, and with great precision, they can't stop the wars that they're, they can't stop the wars. So that means that the people who are being nonviolent and are aggressively pursuing their enemies and loving their enemies in the midst of the wars, after great suffering and torture even, and loss, there's some kind of freaking genius going on there. And we're not studying that genius. So I started to look at these videos that we had taken of these peacemakers. And the videos had all these peacemakers on it that were known as peacemakers, wonderful people. There's chapters on each one of them. But the first chapter is on the guy that was translating. And we happened to have video of him. And we did transcripts. We had the transcripts. And the amazing thing about the human brain, and I'm talking to a lot of my friends about it in our scholarship, is that when you read something and you read it again and again and again, you see different things than you hear. At least I do. I'm not very good at listening, but I'm very good at studying texts. I've been studying texts my whole life. It's sort of part of my cultural constructs. So I do listen to people, I do listen, but not as good as I read. And so I'm reading over the texts, and I started to see these patterns. So Sheikh Bukhari, for example, who died in Jerusalem not long ago, he's from a family, he's a Sufi, and he's been in Jerusalem for 400 years. He's still considered a guest by the local Arab population. He's from Uzbekistan, I think. Bukhari. He's from Bukhara. So where is Bukhara? What? No, it's not Afghanistan. It's Tajikistan. Okay. So he's from there, and Sheikh Bukhari has been there for 400 years. Why did his family come? They came 400 years ago to be a testimony right at the heart of Jerusalem, right next to the Dome of the Rock, to be a space of meeting for all peoples. And I started to discover that not only in Jerusalem, this was the only case I knew in Jerusalem of ancient families that came for that purpose, but then I started to have Hijazi friends in Saudi, and I figured out that in Mecca, around Mecca, there's also this cosmopolitan subtext. Right in the heart of Saudi Arabia, there's sections of people who got used to millions of people coming from different races and cultures for hundreds of years, and it built a different consciousness. And that's where a lot of the Sufi, you know, his Sufi tradition came from. And Sheikh Bukhari was so anti-intellectual. He prided himself on having only a sixth grade education. And he said, you know, he would talk about some professors of Islam that we were talking to in Jerusalem. He said, they're not Muslim. He said to me once, and he never said a negative word, but we were in an emergency room. It was his fourth heart attack. He was really suffering. And I was sitting with him in Hadassah Hospital. And he said, Mark, he's not a real Muslim. And I knew he was in bad shape. I said, why do you say he's not a Muslim? Because anyone who does not have love in their hearts is not a Muslim. I said, yeah, but he knows the whole Quran. He knows the Sharia. He's an expert in Islamic philosophy. And if there's not enough love in his heart, then he's not a Muslim. And so this was his way that he had inherited, you know, from his family. And he used to speak to audiences of Jews and Muslims together, and everyone would fall in love with him. Their hearts would just melt. And I remember looking at the transcript, and I heard it. I was in person with him. And he would say, he said, you know, the Holy Book says that he who saves a single life saves the whole world.
And, you know, I listened, and I'd hear him, and I'd say, oh, that's nice. And then I studied the transcripts. And he's dead, and I'm mourning for him. I went through a terrible loss. It was like my second father to die. Because he really did have love in our heart, in his hearts, and a lot of us in fancy professors do not. We're struggling with a lot of anger. And so I wanted to know what Sheikh Bukhari's secret was, you know. I studied the transcript. And then I looked at it, and I knew. Because many times I've quoted the Quran and I've quoted the Torah. And they both have the statement that he who saves a single life saves the whole world. And he who kills a single person kills the whole world. You know, it's in the Talmud, then it appears in the Quran in a slightly different language, but the same idea. And then I looked at that. And I had quoted it in texts. And then I looked at the transcripts, and I looked, and I said, oh my God, he didn't say the Torah and the Quran say this. He said the holy book says that. And then I realized what he was doing. He was deliberately mixing the two traditions and letting everybody guess. You know, it didn't matter to say it's the holy book. In other words, even in those two words, he was building a transformation of the heart just by saying the holy book. You see what I'm saying? He created, we know in the theory, this is what you, so much of what you studied, we know in the theory of symbol and rituals, and symbol especially, is that symbols embody contradiction. America, the flags of countries embody contradictions. And they're meant to. They're meant to be a place of contradiction that creates harmony of opposites. It's meant to be unity among many, because that's who we are as people. When you want to create a country, you want to create that kind of symbol. But Sheikh Bukhari was taking this family and he was saying, oh, the holy book says. And he did it other times. I started looking at other transcripts and he says, you know, God asked Abraham to sacrifice his only son. I said, oh, he didn't say Isaac. He didn't say Ishmael. He said his only son. So again, this man who didn't need to study social psychology, he didn't need to study a psychoanalysis of demonization and polarization. In his every word, he was embodying love and unity. And I only got it by studying his genius and after he's dead. This chapter I have of his, it's his own words, but he never wrote a single thing. And I worked on the translation of his English into the English that people could really get for 2 years, and it's the only place that he ever wrote. The other person I want to share with you is a man by the name of Ibrahim, who is the translator of all of these in the sessions. And Ibrahim was in the West Bank in Palestine, and Ibrahim tells the story of how he grew up in a difficult time, a difficult place where the Israeli, he was taught by father and grandfather, the Israelis took all of our lands in Haifa, and the only answer is to go back and take them and to fight the Israeli. And then he talks about the fact that at one point during the Intifada, he was throwing stones with the other kids, and he hit an Israeli car. He was taken to jail. He was beat up in jail. But then at a certain point, he talks about the fact that he heard about a seminar in Hebrew University. And he went to this place called the Truman Center. He said for the first time in his life, he met Israelis who actually wanted to help Palestinians. And he said, what the heck is that? And he said, it's a very simple language. He said, I'm going to talk to them. And then he becomes a peace builder. But then something incredible happens, and his son is run over by a settler. And then the son is killed. And you, the language of what he, it's the most honest self-examination of rage that I've ever seen in literature. Because he says, I cannot describe it. I cannot describe the feeling. The feeling is a nuclear bomb. It's a nuclear energy. It's like no energy in the world. And this energy is deep inside of me, and it's coming, and it's coming, and it's coming. And everyone's saying to me, blow yourself up, blow yourself up. The time for peace is over. Blow yourself up. And he could have been. You know, people could have paid him to do that, get insurance for his family and all of that. And then he goes through this self-examined process where he starts asking questions. Who's going to take care of my daughter? He said, is it going to bring back my son? Or is it going to get my other son killed? But then he comes to this space that's the most sophisticated philosophy of democracy that all the great philosophers came to. And he said, I am my own person. I, in my privacy, decide who I am and what I do. And I decide what will happen. Because he knew all of these Israelis. And the Israeli, one Israeli from Tel Aviv called him and he said, I heard about a kid that was run over. And who is it? And he said, that's me. And the two of them from Tel Aviv and from the West Bank, they just start crying on the phone together. And he says it in his own Arabic language. He says, and at this time, we cry at the mobile together. And he said, that's it. Because that's all you do. Because his child is in the ground now. My child is in the ground. And that's it. And then he decides those people want to come and visit his house. And he makes a decision to let them come. And he continues his peace work and he goes on to convert policemen. I mean, this is a very simple man. But his genius was his self-examination. He worked through all of the moral, decent reasons why you have a right to blow yourself up. No one in our field takes seriously the power and legitimacy of revenge. We all say, oh, revenge, that's not good. Well, excuse me, I've seen all of the great wisdom texts. It's not true. It's not that simple. Revenge is justice, and justice is revenge. In many texts, it says, in the ancient texts, in the Bible, and in the Quran, it says, you know, you can take revenge, but it's not wise. What does that mean? You can take revenge, but it's not wise. It means that in a certain way, there has to be justice for what was done to my son. And he says at one point, he says, justice, he said, if they took a flower from my yard, and that means no more boy on Friday. No more boy at the mosque. Then I have to go and take one of their flowers exactly the same. Who can deny the notion of justice that he's talking about? But the great wisdom traditions also said that you have to take justice, whether it's in Sophocles, in ancient wisdom of Greece, or whether it's in the Bible, with the transformation of revenge, or whether it's in the Quran, you see that people at the deepest level of injury who become peace builders are grappling with the legitimacy of revenge as justice, but then they take it and they transform it. Because he says, then he goes on to say, I am going to take my revenge in a different way. I am going to take my revenge in a new way. I am going to conquer them with love. But he's not abandoning his debt to his child. You see? This is all in a transcript from somebody who nobody pays attention to in Palestine or Israel. And it's just social genius. He writes, he acted in a more sophisticated way than the actors in the Sophocles, in the celebrated Sophocles plays, struggling with revenge and justice. And I think that he took it further in a better way than the Old Testament did, with setting up cities for revenge and for people to, you know, the ancient cities of refuge. The whole idea of refuge in the Bible comes from the idea that if I kill you by accident, then your family has a right to kill me. The classic, it's all over the world there are these revenge systems. But the Bible set up refuge cities where if I can run fast enough, you can't kill me in that city, and I have to stay there for the rest of my life. And that was their way of dealing with sort of saying revenge is legitimate, it's legal, but let's try and moderate it. Everybody has this problem, and we're fooling ourselves if we think that in every war zone this isn't the question. But Ibrahim came up with a deeper idea, is that he would take revenge, but he would take revenge with love. And he did it through self-examination. So, I said in the other lecture that a lot of my research now, I'm actually very optimistic, because the statistics are that in every place but the terrible war zones, on balance, we're starting to hurt each other less than we used to. There's far more empathy between races and peoples and religions than ever before in history. There's far less capital punishment. There's torture is illegal in many places, even though it's done, but it's not celebrated anymore, not by religions and not by states. They do it secretly. And it's good to put things into the shadows and then uncover the shadows. And the statistics are indicating the last 50 years is dramatic decrease. And the very fact that we're so outraged and angry from Rwanda to Syria to all of these places is good news, because it means we're all paying attention. We're all paying attention. But as we pay attention, we shouldn't be paying attention to people with PhDs. We should be paying attention to geniuses who know how to overcome their most violent and legitimate feelings. Geniuses who know to make friendships across enemy lines. Geniuses in every culture, from Iran to Afghanistan to others, people who know how to make enemies into friends. And we should be studying them and building them into our leaders for a new and less violent world. We know that this less violent world depends upon literacy, knowing each other, films about each other, social empathy. We know that the rule of law is helping tremendously, where it outlaws torture, where it outlaws human rights violations. All of these are critical for the global community that we're building. But we also, as we get to this stage, need to study the social genius of people who are deeply self-examined, deeply victimized, and translate that victimization and that horror into a genius of reaching out to the other. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark.
And we have, I think we can take about 20 minutes for questions. We would ask people who are going to ask a question or a comment to come to the mic, because we are recording this for a podcast. So please feel free to come with any questions that you have. I'm sure Mark will be happy to answer, and also to hear if there are comments.
I really appreciate very much what you've said and what you've done. This is just kind of a curiosity question. It's not a profound question, but I was in Israel-Palestine 10-15 years ago, and with a Christian Peacemaker team delegation, and met a man, a Palestinian peace warrior by the name of Zugbi, and just wondered if you knew him and whether he was one of the people in your book.
He's not in the book, but Zugbi and I knew each other here. We met here.
Okay.
Because I think he was at the Summer Peacebuilding Institute at one point.
Okay.
So, he's done a lot of great work. I don't work with him on a regular basis, but my friends do.
Okay,
so, yeah.
My name is Will Hairston, and I'm wondering how would you recommend creating a safe space for dialogue in the Middle East to bring different parties to the table?
Yeah. Well, many people have tried to do that for many decades, and there has been a lot of money spent on that, and a lot of projects to make those kind of safe spaces. Like I said, a lot of things can't change very easily when the sheer amount of resources going into keeping it going are far outweigh any resources we could possibly be bringing to solving it because of so many people committed to continuing. At the same time, in terms of the experiments that we see or the relationships that are doing better or the people who are reaching greater numbers, it's not so much by creating safe spaces. That's very labor-intensive, and in our field, people have a lot of what we call re-entry problems. So you create a safe space for a small number of people to talk, and then they re-enter, and the reality is nothing like that. In most conflicts, there's an imbalance between who's more in power and who's less in power. So, you know, people more in power can feel good about the talk, but the people less in power go back to the same situation. The things that I've seen that are more successful are the ones that are building networks of cooperation and building on any number of things that lead towards a less violent and more just society. So when you create a sense of solidarity through any number of approaches, there's a lot of different ways in which we're building civil society across the globe. Some people are working on environment, some people are working on children's rights, some people are working on the rights of minorities, some people are working on language efficiency. There's so many different ways that the bonding experience is the key. Some people are doing it through theology and interfaith dialogue. On balance, whatever the form of cooperation should take place to create that kind of safe space, it should be something that's leading to tangible benefits to everyone who's participating. And I don't mean paying them off, but I mean a way in which people feel that this is leading to a different situation. So I'm much more interested in establishing 10 businesses between equals than I am in 10 conferences. Because the conferences will pay a lot of people a lot of money, and they can all go back to the same situation. But when you create a business between two people who are from enemy groups, and they're equal in that business, and nothing else around them is equal, they're changing history. They're changing their reality. And their families and their families of families are seeing tangible benefits. So the most important thing is that there's tangible difference. I created the other thing that I've done with my Palestinian partner and a Jewish partner, we created, we're interested in tourism and social business. So we created a business of tourism around multiple narratives and investment in honest businesses. And that, the reason why it's taking off is we're not making a whole lot of money about it, but we are paying a lot of people, is that people are seeing the tangible benefits that we're committed to doing. Whether it be a hotel in East Jerusalem and all the people staying there and all the tourists we're bringing to that hotel, all these things are tangible. So the most important thing is that words are very weak things. We have too many of our cultures that are focused on verbiage and the verbal. But in place of distrust, words are not very helpful. It's much more helpful to create projects that see tangible gains and then have those people have that multiply and allow for multiplication. The other thing we're trying to figure out, and the other reason I went to a business model versus a nonprofit model, is that nonprofits are very weak on multiplication, on expansion. They're basically dependent upon the grant or the goodwill of somebody who may lose interest. So I'm interested in very much in modes of living and modes of interaction that can multiply without being dependent upon a donor community. So that's the other thing that we're doing. So all these are safe spaces, but they're not safe spaces in the typical dialogue way, if you know what I mean.
Thank you. I'm a graduate student in the Center for Justice and Peace Building. My question is about the self-assessment of individuals who are in a different role. For example, a politician has specific responsibilities to take certain policies at the state level. While he do understand that, according to his personal perception, it might not be ethical, but the role he is in is challenging. He has to follow the what's so-called conventional wisdom or the reality that a state normally take decisions. And it could be applicable in a policy in an Israel situation. So different people sometimes admit that this is according to personal or their social values are not working, but the role they are playing as a politicians or a business community or intelligence officer, it's different. So how to incorporate that personal values when you are in an official role? Yeah. Thank you.
That's great. That's a great question. And I have a couple of answers to that. But one of the interesting things that's happened is that a lot of us moved into conflict resolution training, even though I don't like the word, and in a lot of cultures it doesn't go over well as a word, but conflict resolution training or education or seminars, because the seminars attract people from every walk of life. And again, it's opening yourself up to the 7 billion. In my classes at SCAR, and in most of our classes, we're astonished by the range of people who take an interest in our work. And those people end up coming from a military community, intelligence community. I feel like I'm the only person on the planet who at the same time, there was a certain period of time where I had intelligence people taking my course in Damascus and intelligence people taking my course in Washington. That was scary, but it was a reality. And what happens is it's like an affection where the simple skill of role-playing, if it's done well, is a brain changer. And it's a brain changer for anybody in any one of their professions. And what I mean by that is that we're hardwired to think that there's only good or evil on one side or another, that we're basically good. There's a lot of terms for this in social psychology, but we're hardwired that way in many ways, to assume our innocence and other people's more responsibility, to look for where the black and white is, where are the people who are bad, where are the people who are good. Many, many people, even in socially progressive work, are really, really burdened by every situation. They have to decide who's good and who's evil. The amazing thing about conflict resolution training is that it mucks all that up. And you can see people change right before your eyes. And then they go back to military, they go back to their bureaucracy, they go back to government, and they're bothered by that. And that's what you want. So it's like an infection. And you have this positive sense that in the complex way in which human societies are organized, from people in business, to people in government, to people in military, that the more people who are adopting more than one consciousness, the harder it's going for them to demonize a group and decide that the answer is in that demonized destruction of the other. And we've seen that happen. You know, we've seen an interesting evolution of more and more chaplains and military people coming to us, more and more intelligence people. And curiously enough, both in the field and here, and in Israel, and in Palestine even, that once you have in place enough oversight, how shall I put this? There's a certain level of people with guns, when they have no oversight, that it's very dangerous. They're very dangerous. But once there's a certain level of oversight and a certain level of self-control, and this is true of police in many different cities. Some police are out of control. Some police already have a lot of good things in place. But once they have some things in place that don't allow them to pursue their worst instincts, the training and conflict resolution takes them even deeper, into a step further. And that's what you want. And what we've discovered more is that we have police, we have military, we have intel people who are far ahead of politicians. Because the tragedy of politicians in democracies even is that they're paid by their constituencies to take demonized and polarized views. In other words, you know, if you have a lobby that's paying you to demonize immigrants, then you demonize immigrants and people vote for you based on that. And there's no thought. Whereas if you have a gun in your hand and there's all sorts of laws in place and you got a situation on the ground in Los Angeles and you've been trained in role-playing, you're going to do something slightly different in that split second you have of whether to shoot or whether to talk. You may think of something that I can say at this moment to this guy that's different because of my training. And that's where we see some really major changes. I have a lot of intelligence people coming to me because I'm realizing more and more that people in intelligence research are not comfortable with the militarization of intelligence. They actually see themselves as researchers. And there's big debates in policy communities about whether intel should be research or whether it should be paramilitary. And we're influencing that debate. Because 5 out of the 6, you have to see this The Gatekeepers is a movie that's come out of 5 of 6 former Israeli heads of intelligence. And the things they're saying about Israel are things that you would only read on a radical lefty website. Saying it's no longer a democracy, this is a state that serves the occupation, that's all that the state is, many, many other things. Because they went through it. You know, I know one of these types, the empathy is unbelievable. The empathy with Muslims, the empathy, once they studied them so up close, I have one guy I know, he's head of the National Security Council in Israel, he's at the forefront of reaching out to Islamic peoples. Because now he knows that making them all Al-Qaeda is insane, it's suicidal, and it's flat out wrong factually. And he's advocating that, but unfortunately he's out of office. And the prime minister who's elected is elected by people who have been persuaded of a polarized position. So this is our challenge, is that the more we can infect with this notion of multidimensionality, the more that we can affect people in all of those different walks of life, the more we can reach out to them. I don't know how to reach out to politicians when they literally will lose their jobs unless they vote a certain way. You know, that's harder. But I do know that we are having a very negative impact on the excessiveness of militarization. In the 1960s, when John Kennedy decided not to blow up the world, he went against all of his generals. But now, when the Prime Minister of Israel wants to bomb Iran, he's going against all of his generals. That's progress. You see, you have to understand that you have to look for increments of positive progress and change, even when it doesn't look linear, even though the war that's about to come scares the hell out of you. But look for what is the good that's happening and build on it. And that's what I'm saying, we have to keep building. I mean, as soon as I can get my hands on them, I want to put together Iranian and Israeli generals. I don't care what the politicians are saying, I want to put them in the same room. I swear to you, they'll start talking the same language. So, yeah.
Thank you. I'm Mansour, doing my sabbatical in CJP. Just, I've got 2 questions. One is, you know, regarding your work in Syria. What positive side do you see in Syrian war? If the regime collapsing and those disintegration of the country, do we see another Iraq or Somalia there, or there would be any positive changes there? And the second one, as you were talking about the different factions playing in Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as I heard, and you were talking about that during the lunchtime, there are a great share coming from the American side and mainly from the evangelical Christian, and they are just fueling this conflict with more power and money. What do you see, or what do you suggest for just, you know, informing these people, transforming these Christian who are just engulfing this conflict there?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. So those are two very good questions. As far as the future of Syria, I've had to. We all went through a lot of a big period of mourning, of deep mourning. I tried to be a little bit more philosophical about it, of accepting the fact that what do I learn from this? I learned that the radical negative energy of police states has consequences, and as they fall apart, terrible, terrible things happen. And I have to be philosophical about the consequences of Ba'athism. I think Ba'athism, both in Iraq and Syria, have had a disastrous, effect, which makes me more hopeful in Iran, by the way, because I think that whatever you say about the fiqh idea, the idea of who Khomeini's theological power and all of that, there's so much more that's healthier beneath the surface. The history demonstrates that when there's a healthy substratum, that even when the worst things happen, the recovery is much quicker. So that, for example, Germany reaches the worst of the worst possible total destruction, and yet the recovery is remarkable. Part of it is because of the Cold War and investment in West Germany, but honestly, there was a very big democratizing aspect to German culture. Kant is German, and Kant still is the key blueprint for global community. And that also was German. So there was a substratum, and that's why I'm more hopeful about the Iranian future with this anomaly of this odd notion of religious absolute leadership. At the same time, in Syria and Iraq, we're still paying for an old totalitarian philosophy that was influenced by National Socialism. And we see the horror of that. Where does the hope come from? Where do I see things going? In a lot more of the community, and this sort of answers the Palestinian situation, we really need a lot more of the globalized community to be investing in the fundamental relationships across ethnic and cultural lines of building people for democracy. And I don't mean my kind of democracy, but simple, the relationships of what I call social contract. The more that there can be any kind of programs that build Shiite, Sunni, Christian, secular Muslim relationships in any projects in Syria with Syrians, the more that people get used to that kind of coalition building and that kind of role taking and caring and not demonizing, and it's going to have to be a deep reaching out to Alawites, the more that you're planting the seeds of a different future. And it's the same in, because the forces destroying Syria now are really overwhelming. The Russian government and the Iranian regime are determined to not lose their one last ally with a deep seaport and so on. The Saudis and the Qataris are determined to have this be a state that the Ikhwan will get. And then there's all these liberals floating around, fighting for their rights in a very legitimate way. The Americans don't know what the hell they're doing. The European countries also don't know what to do. There isn't enough of a globalized movement of people, of people-to-people work, working with Syrians inside and out of Syria to build trust and build relationships and build hope in many, many different kinds of nonviolent activities. I don't see that yet. I see us all hoping that the American government or the European government is going to fund this project and that project. I don't see the globalized investment in the Syrian people that we need. And it's going to be the same in Israel-Palestine. We still hope blindly that governments will solve the problem, but they don't. They're all focused on their national interest. And none of them, the power brokers here, the lock that the evangelical lobby and the Israeli lobby have on Washington, all of these things are very locked in place. And I don't see governments as coming up with that solution as much as a transformation. That's why, for many years now, I've been begging, and I had my issues with the Mennonite engagement in Israel-Palestine. I wanted them to express, if love of enemy and care for enemy is such a key aspect of conflict resolution, I wanted them to do that just as much with Jews as they were doing with Palestinians. Because even though the Jews have the greater power there, the fact is that you just can't change people by hating them or ignoring them. and that we need to find forms of resistance that really are through love, not through indifference or not through hate. And so far, I've seen extremely weak forms of nonviolent resistance in Israel or in Palestine by Jews themselves that really is born of love and care. Everybody hates everybody in Israel. It's really, really sick from post-Holocaust trauma. The secular hate the religious, and the religious, ultra-religious, you know, hate the other, the secular, and everybody hates the people of color. It's really a situation that's not good. And then the people who are trying to create unity, they're trying to create unity of Jews over against Arabs. And so we don't need that. We need the kind of guidance of a love-based resistance to injustice that simply incrementally creates a new social contract. And I know that's where the answers lie, because that's what's happened in other places. The paradigm shift with Belfast is that we had enough Americans of Irish descent who outspent the war makers. But we had a lot of people of goodwill that had to get to that point to make that fun. There were enough Irish people in this country who told their congressmen, hey, I want a fund that's going to be really big, that's going to make a difference in Belfast. And then it happened. We have a younger generation of evangelicals who don't like militant religion. They don't like violent religion. We have a lot of young Jews who are not sold on the idea that Holocaust and anti-Semitism is my Jewish identity. We have a lot to work with, but I don't think we have enough third parties yet who care enough to really get in there and build the coalitions. So I hope it'll come. The other thing I want to say, and this is a universal truth here now that should be, I've seen it universally. The Iranian community, for example, there's two sides to the Iranian community, completely divided. There's the people who believe in sanctions. Certainly the monarchists do, but others believe in sanctions. Get rid of the regime as much as you can, especially people who've been out of the country for a long time. But the people who haven't been out for very long and they have their families suffering, they're not crazy about sanctions at all. And then you have all these people committed. And then there are people who want to sanction Israel and Israelis and Jews, etc., and boycott Israel. It's all the same subject. The subject is, how do you turn somebody's heart? Do you do it by punishment? Do you do it by depriving people? Do you do it by starving people? Do you do it by taking medicine out of the hands of children in Iran? Do you do it by humiliating Israelis? The evidence of history is no, you don't. South Africa was the big exception. And there are other reasons why that reached a critical mass. We have to really be careful with thinking that disengagement and isolation works. I don't believe the evidence is there at all. The evidence is, on the contrary, that engagement kills radical philosophies. Engagement kills radical philosophies. Investment kills radical philosophies. Business people, artists, are the great champions of international peace, historically speaking. And the more you allow that to happen, the harder it is for people to construct polarized philosophies. The best way to conquer hatred of Iran now, a desire for Iran, is for people to engage, engage, engage. The best thing for the Arab world to do is to rush to Israel with their businesses and say, we want to come. And by the way, what are you going to do about the Palestinians? We're going to come to Israel, but we're going to invest completely in the Palestinian people. What are you going to do? And you will see the whole Jewish community in an uproar, just like when Sadat came. And the tide will turn, and Netanyahu will be gone. So that's my belief. My belief is engagement, 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 engagement with Iran, engagement with Israel, engagement with everybody who you think you hate the most. And that's the best way to get rid of war criminals, the best way to get rid of bad philosophies. So, okay.
Well, Mark, we certainly thank you for coming back again after these years, and you've given us a lot to think about, a lot of inspiring words, and we need to have you come back more regularly. So we'll do that.
Thank you.